Welcome to this deep dive. Today we're focusing on a very specific blueprint for personal architecture. We're looking at chapter 15 from Laws of Life, book 1, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by Jack Spirko.
Yeah, and it's a heavy chapter.
It really is. I mean, think of a bridge on a perfectly sunny 70 degree day, right? Cars are just gliding across. The water below is completely still. That bridge looks, well, invincible.
Sure.
But you only find out what that bridge is actually made of when, you know, a Category 5 hurricane rolls in and the water starts battering the pillars.
Right.
And today, we're basically testing the engineering of human integrity.
I like that analogy.
Thanks. And just to give you some context on how we're approaching Spirko's text today, you know, I spend my days as an ethics and leadership professor. So I study how responsibility, reputation, and trust function, or in a lot of cases, entirely collapse under pressure.
Right. And my lens on this material comes straight from the trenches, really. As a small business operator and a team leader, I've been in those exact situations where keeping a commitment meant taking a direct, painful hit.
Yeah, you've lived it.
Oh, absolutely. I've had to hold the line when doing so literally cost me money, opportunity, and, you know, professional advantage. It's not just theory for me.
Exactly. So our mission today is to thoroughly unpack, actively challenge, and apply the core teaching of Spirko's chapter 15. The law itself is actually simply stated, which is always keep your word, especially when doing so is difficult.
But he doesn't just, you know, hand us this law in a vacuum.
No, he doesn't. He uses this vivid metaphor of a woven cloth. He argues the laws of life aren't some a la carte menu where you can just pick law 15 and ignore the rest. They're totally interconnected. If you pull on one thread, the entire pattern weakens.
Yeah, and that interconnectedness is where the rubber really meets the road. For instance, Spirko explicitly ties Law 15 to Law 16, which is all about choosing true friends, like people you actually want to emulate.
Right, because the company you keep matters.
Exactly. Because if you surround yourself with people who lack character, keeping your word to them suddenly becomes a trap.
Oh, that's a great point.
Yeah, you find yourself bound by honor to people who operate with basically none. But there's another connection he makes that I find incredibly compelling from a, you know, from a business standpoint, and that's to Law 14.
Law 14 being the principle that economies grow by companies growing new markets rather than just poaching market share from others.
Right. And Spirko illustrates this with a really fascinating story from his own life back in, I think it was 2008. He was deeply involved in online forums focused on preparedness and homesteading.
And he had a stellar reputation there, right?
He did. It was actually that community interest that inspired him to launch a podcast on those subjects in the first place.
Okay, so the conventional playbook for any entrepreneur in that situation is pretty obvious. You heavily promote your new venture in the forums where you already have clout. I mean, the audience is sitting right there.
Exactly. But Spirko, he completely stopped posting in those forums.
Wait, entirely?
Entirely. He backed away completely because he refused to be seen as a poacher. He went broad, instead marketing to the general public to grow a brand new market.
No, I have to push back on this just a little bit, just from an academic business ethics perspective.
I'm for it.
I mean, in free market capitalism, if I build a better product or a more engaging podcast, shouldn't I try to win those listeners over? Why do I owe the legacy market anything? Isn't poaching just, well, a negative word for competition?
It's a really crucial distinction, and Spirko outlines it clearly in the text. Look, competition is healthy, right? It drives innovation. But what we're talking about here is leveraging someone else's infrastructure, a forum they paid for, they moderated, they built to siphon off their community for your own marketing funnel.
Ah, I see. It's like sneaking into someone else's orchard instead of planting your own trees.
Exactly. If you scorch the earth by raiding other people's communities, you destroy any potential for future alliances.
But business is often about creative destruction. If my product is superior, aren't I doing the consumer a favor by bringing them over?
You might be doing the consumer a favor, sure, but you're proving to your industry peers that you operate purely on self-interest. You're showing them you're willing to break the implicit rules of a shared community.
Right, you're breaking trust.
Yes. And Spirko's choice not to do that resulted in this massive indirect payoff. As his show grew independently, he started attracting sponsors. And one of his very first sponsors was a company called Backwoods Home Magazine.
And he was already a big fan of them, wasn't he?
Yeah, he had revered their writers and been a subscriber for 17 years.
And the twist here is that Backwoods Home Magazine actually ran one of the specific forums that Spirko had explicitly stopped posting in. The owner, Dave Duffy, eventually trusted Spurco enough to initiate a sponsorship relationship.
Which really brings it all together. Would Dave Duffy have ever trusted Spurco, let alone, you know, paid him for advertising, if Spurco had spent the last 2 years sneaking into Duffy's digital living room to steal his guests?
Not a chance.
No, zero chance. By growing a new market instead of poaching, Spurco modeled integrity before anyone even asked him to.
That's a fascinating look at indirect integrity. But I want to elevate the stakes here a bit.
Okay.
Because it's relatively easy to do the right thing when we're just talking about market strategy and long-term brand building.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to this law when keeping your word threatens your entire career?
Yeah, that takes us to the emotional core of this chapter, which is the Ron Hood story. So early in Spurco's podcasting venture, he was invited to speak at a huge industry event. And the biggest name in that space at the time was a man named Ron Hood,
who had built a massive, really successful forum and community of his own.
Right. And everyone wanted a piece of Ron. They were constantly crowding him, looking for endorsements or a handout, basically.
But when Spurco was finally introduced to Ron at this massive dinner, he did something completely unexpected.
Yeah, he didn't ask for a single favor. Instead, he mentioned his podcast was gaining traction and offered to have Ron on as a guest to help Ron reach a brand new, younger demographic.
So he flipped the script entirely from, can you help me, to can I help you?
Exactly. And that one interaction sparked this deep friendship. They started talking multiple times a week. Ron even asked Spurco to write a column for a new magazine he was launching. They basically became business partners.
But then the environment changed rapidly. The event where Spurco originally met Ron was backed by a magazine that's now out of print, but the event itself relied heavily on Ron's forum for its audience.
Yeah, and when Ron launched his own magazine, the other group viewed it as a direct hostile threat. It escalated into this bitter feud behind the scenes, culminating in this group officially banning Ron from their upcoming event.
And this ban happens just weeks before the event, the exact same event where Spurco is scheduled to be a featured speaker.
So Spurco is staring down the barrel of a major professional crisis. He's still really early in his career. The people running this event are deeply connected industry insiders.
Right, the gatekeepers.
Exactly. If he pulls out, he risks his reputation with these organizers. The very real fear is that they will just freeze him out of future opportunities entirely.
But the choice he makes cuts through the noise. Spurco pulls his support. He refuses to speak.
He just walks away.
Yeah, he simply tells his audience that Ron is his friend and business partner, and if Ron is unwelcome, he cannot support or attend the event. It's a massive professional gamble.
And the aftermath of that decision is, well, it's tragic, but profoundly clarifying. Sometime later, completely unrelated to this industry drama, Ron, who is a Vietnam veteran with Agent Orange exposure and who had been battling cancer, passes away suddenly in his sleep from a heart attack right next to his wife, Karen.
Wow. And Spurco gets this news the next morning. It hits him so hard he has to pull his car over at the bottom of his mountain just to have a quiet, undisturbed phone call with Ron's wife, Karen. And before he can even offer his condolences, Karen's very first words to him on the phone are, "God, he loved you, Jack."
That's the ultimate crystallization of this law.
It really is. That is the exact moment the phrase, "especially when doing so is difficult," became permanent architecture in Spurco's mind. In the moment he pulled out of that event, the career fear was palpable. But hearing Karen's words, the right choice was undeniable.
You keep your word to the man who always kept his to you, regardless of the professional fallout.
Absolutely.
What stands out to me is how a high-stakes crisis makes the right decision obvious in hindsight. But in our day-to-day lives, the stakes rarely feel like a dramatic showdown. We aren't always facing a career-ending ultimatum. Sometimes we just, well, we screw up.
Which is a perfect pivot. How does Law 15 apply when you are the one who made a mistake? Spurco totally flips the little boy who cried wolf dynamic here.
I love this part.
Right. We're taught that fable is about the malice of lying. If you lie, people won't believe the truth. But Spurco argues that we are so focused on intentional malice, we ignore the reality of honest incompetence.
Yeah, he outlines a scenario where you make a bad recommendation to your followers or your customers, and they lose money or time because they trusted you. Based on your daily track record of integrity, there are two distinct outcomes.
Let's hear them.
So, outcome one is the result of having a history of offloading blame and making excuses.
And this is where Spurco brings in Laws 8 and 9, which deal with pattern recognition and personal accountability. Shifting blame isn't just a bad look. It literally breaks your brain's ability to learn.
How so?
Well, if you constantly tell yourself that external factors caused your failure, you stop scanning for the actual variables you got wrong. You destroy your own pattern recognition. So when you screw up your recommendation, your followers feel completely betrayed. You end up immortalized on Yelp and the Better Business Bureau as a total fraud.
Right. But outcome two is entirely different. You make the exact same bad recommendation. The financial loss to your followers is identical, but your track record is different.
Because you have a history of owning it.
Exactly. You are known for accepting blame, providing reasons, but never offering excuses. So when you realize the error, you step up immediately. You apologize, explain exactly where your analysis went wrong, and you own the failure.
And the psychological shift in the audience is incredible. The same people who would have burned your name in outcome one will look at outcome two and say, he's a straight shooter, he made a mistake, but he owned it. They attribute it to a simple error, not malice.
Which brings us to the million-dollar question posed by the text. If every thinking person generally agrees that they should keep their word and own their mistakes, why is it so rare in practice?
Incrementalism. The insidious psychology of incrementalism. Spurko uses an analogy about diet and exercise, but I like to think about it like ship navigation.
Okay, walk me through that.
If you are navigating a ship across the ocean and your compass is off by 90 degrees, you realize it immediately. The feedback loop is obvious. But if you are off by just one single degree, the day-to-day experience on the boat feels perfectly fine.
You don't even notice.
Right. You don't realize you're off course until a month later when you make landfall on the wrong continent.
That is exactly how human reputation works. A personal brand isn't usually destroyed by one massive theatrical villain arc. It's destroyed through small, forgivable, poor choices made daily over decades.
Death by a thousand cuts.
Exactly. To illustrate this, the chapter gives us a brilliant corporate workplace scenario featuring three characters: Mike, the department head, and his two employees, Sue and David.
Oh man, if you are listening to this and you manage a team, you're going to feel the stress of this scenario immediately.
You really will. So Sue is tasked with providing a financial forecast. She makes a major mathematical error. Mike, trusting her, takes her numbers, puts them into his slide deck, and presents them to his boss and the board of directors.
A recipe for disaster.
Totally. The boss catches the error live in the meeting. Mike somehow manages to smooth it over and survive the presentation, but there's a reckoning waiting for him.
So Mike has a fork in the road here.
Right. Pape Mike goes to his boss and tells the truth that Sue provided the numbers and the error was entirely hers. Word of this eventually gets back to Sue. Nobody gets fired, but Mike has successfully thrown his subordinate under the bus to save his own ego.
And the trust is just gone?
Evaporated. Sue and David instantly realize Mike has no real loyalty to them. Furthermore, Mike's boss sees a guy who passes the buck when the pressure is on.
Then we have path B. The error is found live in the room, and Mike simply looks at the board and says, I should have caught that. He protects Sue. He never even mentions her name.
And what happens next?
When word gets back to Sue, she and David gain immense, unwavering respect for Mike. And importantly, Mike's boss, who isn't stupid, you know, he knows Mike didn't crunch the raw data himself, realizes that Mike is a stand-up guy who acts as a shield for his team.
Fast forward 10 years. Path A creates a manager who is surrounded by a toxic, disloyal, self-serving team. Path B creates a leader who is, as Spurko writes, as rare as gold and worth more than his wheat in it.
But let me play devil's advocate for a second, because our listeners are probably thinking the exact same thing. Sue literally made the mistake. The math error was hers. Why on earth is it Mike's responsibility to take a reputational bullet for someone else's incompetence?
Because that is the logical trap society sets for us, trying to separate authority from accountability. Spurgo's logic cuts right through it. How did that error get into the boardroom?
Mike presented it.
Right. Why didn't Mike catch it during review? Who manages Sue's workload? Who is responsible for training Sue to ensure accuracy? The answer to every single one of those questions is Mike.
We are so heavily programmed by modern corporate culture and politics to say, it's not my fault, it was a systemic issue. Or, you know, blame the junior analyst.
Always blame the junior analyst.
Right. But Spurko argues that this mindset is a giant pile of nonsense. If you want to operate with integrity, you have to completely overwrite your mental programming with a new, uncompromising responsibility code. Everything that happens is my responsibility.
It's a heavy burden, but once you accept that code, keeping your word actually becomes a natural byproduct. However, for those moments when the pressure is immense, the stakes are high, and your brain is screaming at you to break a commitment to save yourself. Spurco provides a highly practical framework.
The Iron Method.
Yeah, the Iron Method. It's a mental filter designed to help you hold the line.
This is where we get into the psychological friction of this law. Let's break down the acronym. The I stands for Identify the Commitment. This sounds simple, but human psychology makes it incredibly difficult.
Because we lie to ourselves.
We do. When we are under pressure, our ego will retroactively blur the lines of what we promised. We start telling ourselves, well, I only said I would try to do it, or I didn't explicitly promise that timeline. You have to get crystal clear on what you actually agreed to, not what is convenient for you in hindsight.
Exactly. Once you identify the real commitment, you move to remove the excuses. And the step is, well, it's brutal. In the business trench, the reasons you want to back out of a commitment are usually very real and very terrifying.
Like bankruptcy.
Yeah, losing a major client, facing financial ruin, dealing with immense stress, those are valid fears.
Yeah.
But the Iron Method forces you to acknowledge that those fears, however real, do not magically erase the contract you entered into.
Which forces you into the O, own the outcome. This is where you accept the toll.
Yeah.
Keeping your word might literally cost you something tangible. It might cost you money. It might cost you status. It might cost you a relationship.
It'll hurt.
It is. But that is the literal price of integrity. If you aren't willing to pay that toll when the bill comes due, your word was entirely worthless from the beginning.
And finally, we have N, never break it for convenience. Spurco makes a vital real-world distinction here. He isn't saying you must march off a cliff blindly. You absolutely can and should break a commitment if the other party starts engaging in illegal or highly immoral activity.
Right. You're not bound to a sinking ship of criminals.
Exactly. Your obligation to baseline morality supersedes a business contract. But you must never, ever break a commitment simply because backing out is easier, safer, or more profitable.
Because the moment you break your word for convenience, you are actively rewiring your brain's neuroplasticity. You are training yourself to be an unreliable narrator of your own life. And that incremental decay, like we talked about with the ship, will spread into your marriage, your parenting, and your self-worth.
It bleeds into everything.
It really does. Your brain is a survival machine. It will always try to protect your ego long before it protects your integrity. You'll hear yourself saying things like, well, the situation changed, or I have to do what's best for my family right now.
And if you want to dive deeper into how to combat those rationalizations and find more resources to help you build this kind of unbreakable personal infrastructure, I highly recommend checking out jackslaws.com. The material there goes much deeper into these exact frameworks.
Absolutely. I want to challenge you listening right now. Look at your own life today. Identify one commitment, a meeting, a project, a promise to a friend that you are currently rationalizing your way out of. Run it through the Iron Method. Identify the commitment. Remove your valid excuses. And own the outcome.
It's a great exercise.
As we close out this deep dive, Spurco leaves us with a specific mental rewrite. He asks us to program 3 exact lines of code into our mental computer to permanently overwrite the societal programming we've been fed. I want you to absorb these exactly as they are written at the end of the chapter. Computer, what we Edward. Everything that happens is my responsibility. Computer, all commitments are contracts. Never let me enter one lightly. Computer, when keeping my word becomes hard, that is when it matters most.
Powerful stuff.
Think back to our bridge in the hurricane. You do not build the bridge during the storm. You rely on the structural integrity you built when the weather was calm. Build your integrity now so it holds when the wind starts howling.
And be sure to check out jackslaws.com for more on this text.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.